welcome to Teaching Here and There, the podcast that looks at hybrid teaching in higher education, the ups, the downs, the ins, the outs, and the should I give this a try? My name's Dom Pates.
I'm James Rutherford.
And I'm Ivan Sikora.
And today we are going to be talking to Peter Jameson, most recently a special advisor on the design of learning environments at the University of Melbourne, but with a long and glittering career of thinking about education, teaching spaces, learning, many different factors around there as well. We've got a fascinating conversation lined up with Peter. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Today, we're delighted to have Peter Jameson with us, talking about his experiences in higher education. Peter, perhaps you'd like to give us just a little introduction to our listeners about your career and what you're doing now.
Thank you, James. Really nice to be with you all and to speak with your listeners. Very quickly, my experience in this background goes back to 1989 and into 1990, where I set up an interactive television and video conferencing system in Victoria to deliver education to remote locations, very remote locations, but also people in isolation, in prisons, people in hospitals. No one had done this here before, so there's no guidebook. I really had to make up most of the rules because there was no one to even ask what the rules could be. Got away with a lot of things. It was successful. Suddenly I had a career as this guy who was leading this project that a few months earlier, I knew nothing about. I'd never heard the word video conferencing before I was asked to do this project. I led a whole series of projects using this technology over a number of years, trying to take live lessons from museums to remote schools that could not otherwise access resources that were centrally located in our capital city, that sort of thing. Then over time, I gradually started to think about the importance of the physical spaces where learning was taking place, and I turned my hand to designing learning environments. Again, I didn't have a rule book and there was no one to ask, but I knew what I thought would make a better classroom. Started designing furniture and laying out things and small projects, they became successful. Suddenly I had a reputation for doing that. Again, there was no title for the job, but my career seemed to be booming in that area. I was offered a number of promotions across universities over time and eventually was offered work around the world internationally at a number of universities and schools and colleges where I was designing physical spaces. So ironically, I started off working with the technologies, linking physical spaces. And then ultimately my real attention focused on the classroom because I felt that it was the universal thing. It was common across all cultures, all countries, all educational systems. And as I traveled the world, I discovered that they were equally disappointing across all those examples, and someone might be able to make a bit of a difference. So that's really how my career spanned over the last 30 years or so.
Thank you, Peter. So your last role, as you're now a gentleman of leisure, I understand, was a professor at University of Melbourne. But thinking back to your previous experience, and I know you told me you'd done a PhD in this subject, what was your experience of live teaching with this mixed audience across Australia?
It was challenging, and I want to put that out there for people who are coming to this perhaps for the first time or thinking about coming to it for the first time or maybe being required to become involved in this sort of activity, even perhaps against their will, but circumstances, you know. It's a challenge, but I think most people are up to the challenge. It was exciting. If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind flipping the conversation a little bit, because for me, what interested me was how you could help students learn best.
Right.
And so that was the thing that I was interested in the use of the technologies across all the different contexts in where I was using those technologies in the pioneering days, if I can call it that. And then subsequently in the design of the physical learning spaces that I've done internationally in many countries, it was about learning. And the reason I'm putting that out there is that I think there's a tendency, and it's really important to avoid this, I think, a tendency to treat this use of technologies now, the environments we're talking about today, linking places, multiple locations and various groups of students with teachers, one or more in various locations. There's a tendency to think of that as a logistical exercise or a technical exercise. And the moment that people begin to think in that mode, through all my research from my PhD, but all the practical experience too, I discovered that they forgot about the most important thing, and that was the student who was to be doing the learning. So the task seemed so big, the exercise was so challenging. It was about, will the technology work? How does the technology work? I've got to be in command of the technology. It's another job for me, the teacher, you know, on top of all the other things I have to do. And I use the word teacher, but I'm referring to university lecturers or anyone who's in a teaching mode in any level of education. And it was always about the technology, the systems and all that sort of thing, and the fear that something was going to go wrong and it's my reputation at stake and I'll be made to look foolish and all those things. And I understand the validity of that, but most of the teachers, in my experience, couldn't move past that. And so even if they did move past that, the best most of them could get to was, okay, yeah, I'm comfortable with the technology. You know, these days that people are more comfortable with the technology, I think. But then it becomes all about them and their performance, their role of teaching, their act of teaching. And almost never is anybody thinking about how does a student learn effectively in this context, whatever the context may be. And so for me, that was always the question. And that allowed me to have a greater authority in a way, because I never felt subservient to the technical experts who knew much more about the technology than myself, for instance. I never thought of it as a technical exercise. I never thought of it as a logistical exercise. I was thinking about how does this make sense and how does this have value for the student who is remote from me, as well as the students who might be in attendance with me.
And I think that's a really good point to make, Peter, because the reaction to hybrid teaching largely since the COVID pandemic started has been one of expediency. How do we do this? How do we get people connected? And it's...
We fix problems.
Yeah, it's a problem to be solved, and largely a technical problem, financial problem. You know, students bring money in, or we've got to have them in, we've got to have them on board. But you're absolutely right. It's almost the most important part of this becomes way down the line of priorities.
Yes.
It's been a pragmatic solution. We've got to fix this. Let's be pragmatic about this. But ultimately, what's a university for?
And that's the other question that I wrote down in preparation for this. I wanted to remind all of us that we need to remember that this is about the university experience. What is that meant to be? And me as an educator, my background is education. For me, the issue was, what's the essence of being at university? And I thought university was to transform people, to give an opportunity for people to discover themselves, to find themselves, and to enter the world, be able to enter the world in a meaningful way. But I feel university should be about transformation. And for me, that meant connecting to the students and allowing the students to find a voice. So ironically, in this technology, and I've chosen that word voice, I want to highlight that word, underline it for the listeners, because everybody presumed when this technology came along that the critical thing was being able to see each other, as we're doing now, as in the essence of doing this conversation. That was the new thing that 30 years ago, that hadn't been done. Suddenly people seeing each other across distances, and you can see this remote group of faces who previously would be on the end of a telephone speaker. Now we could see each other and talk to each other on equal terms. But the interesting thing for me was very early on, it was clear that it wasn't the pictures that were important. It was the quality of the sound. Because if the picture cut out and people could still communicate, the voice was the thing that was most important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas if the picture stayed there and the sound cut out, the whole thing was meaningless. And it was really funny. People were obsessed with being able to see each other and how do I look on the screen and all of that. It was all about the voice for me. Mm. So the teachers who taught most effectively in this mode were the ones who gave voice to the students. Stopped looking at themselves on the screen. Stopped controlling the technology. In my PhD, that was critical. The teachers who taught best were the ones who gave control of the technology in those days to the students.
I'll just add in at that point, that's to sort of underline that. Today, when in a largely online world for higher education through the pandemic, one of the big burning issues is this cameras on or off thing. Whereas when I was training academics in the use of video conferencing systems, and Ivan will remember this as well, from before any of us had heard of coronavirus, it was like, don't bother with your camera. You know, maybe turn it on at the beginning, and so that if they've never seen you before, they can see. But let them listen to you. Listen to them as well. It's key.
Yeah, it's the voice is the most important thing in all of this. And voice as in not just hearing as in the, you know, the technical reception of a sound coming through the system. I don't mean it as much as in that sense, but more in terms of the voice and having something to say and the opportunity to say it. That's where you find yourself and that's where you transform yourself. That's where you discover what being at universities is all about. And it's really important to give students that opportunity. And in a regular classroom, that's still really rare for many students to have that opportunity because of the location of the room or the layout of the room or the fit out of the room or the relationship, the physical relationship of the teacher to the students, student body in the room. You know, it's really difficult to have a voice if you're up the back somewhere where no one can see who you are anyway and they don't know who you are and they don't know that you're sort of half itching to ask a question. And that's the sort of stuff that James and I were interested in addressing in our work with Learning Spaces. How do we create rooms that take away the sense of a front of house where the teacher's on show up there and it's all about him or her? And how do we get classrooms that engage students and give them an opportunity to work in a wide range of ways and to do a wider range of learning tasks to do the learning, as opposed to just sitting there passively taking notes badly? Because all the research showed that students, if you take up the notes from a group of students, a class of students at the end of a lesson, and you look at the notes they've taken, you'd think that they're in attendance at various different classes, that they hadn't been in attendance at the same class. So the note-taking skills of students varies enormously. The sense that they make varies enormously. The misunderstandings that are impressed into the material at the outset when they heard it, and the teacher doesn't know as a student's transcribing that the student's taken something down incorrectly. And they usually give very little opportunity for feedback in exchange, so the teacher doesn't even get to discover that Fred in the back corner completely misunderstands it. It wasn't Churchill who led the British government during the Second World War. It was blah, 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 you know, whatever the view is that they might have, you know. You've got to be able to correct that at the moment that the mistake's made. But the research shows that students take many things down incorrectly and take it home and research it and, practice it, prepare it for the exam and repeat it in the exam. But no one's given them a process of exchange and interaction where the student can reveal, oh, hang on, I misunderstood. I've got it down that, you know, Hitler was in charge of the UK during the Second World War. Oh, what a silly mistake. Yeah, I'm being silly, except that's the sort of errors that students make.
Sure.
And they don't know it's wrong. They're not sitting there deliberately making mistakes. They've made a mistake.
When you mentioned your PhD in video conferencing, at that time, we all can agree that at that time, with the change in technology and the generations of technology development since then, we have made a quantum leap in what is possible. But my early experiences and actually recollection of what I have been reading about Australia was actually that distance education, flying teachers, flying doctors actually have been an essence of development and maybe sustaining that part of the society in Australia for a long time. So when we talk about your PhD in video conferencing and basically the needs of Australian society, how do you see that basically this practice of live teaching with video or just audio helped Australia to reach to the point where actually it replaced potentially the need to move physically the resources, teacher, a doctor, around the place and actually help people develop and enjoy the life to the fullest itself?
I think there's a spectrum that we've got to create and to put those experiences in. One end of the spectrum is not unlike the times that I was talking about in my introduction, where we were using technology to give opportunities to people who were physically remote, or isolated because of their circumstances in prisons or in hospitals and were unable to attend campus. That's one end of the spectrum, and that's in terms of opportunity. And we're using telemedicine here very successfully at the moment. It's boomed in this current time and being funded more and more. It's very successful. But that's a very different experience that's getting access to resources that you would not otherwise have access to. And being the recipient of some technical skills or some knowledge that you need immediately to apply immediately, particularly if it's an urgent medical situation. The other end of the spectrum is you know, you take a philosophy course or an art history course or a history of the Crusades course or contemporary politics course, the exchanges are very different. The purpose of the coming together is very, very different. I'm not after the essential bit of how do I operate on myself? I've just chopped off half my arm. I'm in the Australian outback, and how do I save myself from bleeding to death? That's one use of the technology. But when I've got a class there that's come together to discuss the nature of physical place and how it affects the notion of being human, mm-hmm. We're going to have a very different conversation, and the outcome is going to be extremely different to the one at the other end of the spectrum where someone's trying to help me stop my arm bleeding mm-hmm. forever. So you've got to understand the context. The contexts are really different. So what's the purpose of a higher education coming together versus the delivery of essential technical skill in the moment?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I have to say, working with Dominic on a project that we have started, my naive question of actually bringing a person in a classroom remotely panned to the side of technology, of what we need to think about, and also all these intricate, I think probably it's a background information of what you have said, how to make the education experience, how to maximize education experience in a way. And that is actually something what I see nowadays, me teaching in a classroom as a main challenge, because technology is available, probably compared to 1998, when you finished, or 1999, when you finished your PhD, we are just, I don't know how many miles away from that point on.
I continue to use the technology beyond that time. So I saw the technologies change and become, you know, incredibly powerful. I think it's easy, just if I could pick up something in your comment, I think it's the easiest thing to do to use these technologies to connect to a remote expert or authority, to bring someone into the classroom electronically, if you like, who would not otherwise be able to participate. That we could now feasibly have Barack Obama join the class to talk about US politics. We couldn't get him to turn up at Melbourne University to do a lesson on that. But that's the easy bit. The problem is in looking at that as being the easy bit, and I can understand the benefit in doing that. I'm all for that. But the problem is that focuses again on the talking voice. It focuses on the expert that we bring into the classroom. I want to constantly remind the listeners to this podcast that it's a student voice that I think we've got to remind ourselves has to be given an opportunity and has to be fostered and has to be encouraged and enabled. And that's the voice that, again, when you bring in that expert, that voice is even more remote. The student voice is pushed into the background because, you know, if we bring Barack Obama into our politics class, it's a special opportunity. We want to listen to Barack Obama. We don't want to listen to, you know, some silly questions from the back of the room. You know what I mean? And I don't mean that in a disparaging way to the students.
Yeah,
but that's how it can easily seem. So, again, there's a lot of pressure to suppress the student voice because we've only got this rare opportunity. We've got this guest who's kindly agreed to come into our class from his house in California or something for the hour. We can't take up all of his time having nonsense conversation amongst the students at three different locations. Point that I would stress is, on the one hand, yeah, Barack Obama, if we get him into the class on this computer link, is a great asset to the class. But I would want to stress to the university teachers and teachers of any level that it's the students who are the most important resource in the classroom. And I learned that by being exposed to some great educators in my early times at university when I was a staff member. And they were leaders in the research. They'd done some of the most important research in the UK and across Europe and in Australia on student learning. In the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, these people were the people who changed the way we thought about student learning. And they emphasized student learning, not effective teaching. It was all about student learning. How do we help students learn better?
So, Peter, let me jump in here with my next question, which I think dovetails really nicely with what you said. And that's a great example of bringing about Barack Obama into your politics class. You know, if we consider that maybe this kind of mode of teaching is being probably accelerated these days as a result of navigating the new mid post-pandemic world and you know, that kind of context. So there's probably a lot more of the
rising pressures to do this sort of thing. Teachers will go back into the physical or the virtual classroom with their teacher heads on, naturally. But there's also a lot of talk, thankfully, about things like inclusivity these days. And there's a key driver as well. And really, this aligns with what you're talking about the student voice. So in terms of making this kind of hybrid educational mode authentic, making it inclusive in particular for students, what are your views on good ways to achieve that?
I think the first thing we need to acknowledge, and I don't want anyone to take offence at this, but you know, historically, we know that the vast majority of university teaching staff are not trained in pedagogy. They're not trained in teaching and learning. They're trained in the disciplinary field. That's the first thing we need to state. And yeah, people bring lots of their experience to the situation, but they also bring lots of misunderstandings and falsehoods about what's effective. You know, you still get many teachers who rabbit on, senior academics who rabbit on about the effectiveness of lecturing, because that's what they like to do, or that's what they're used to doing, or that's what they think they're good at. But we know all the research around the world tells us it's not a particularly effective way of teaching and learning. I think we need to address that issue. We need to remind ourselves that we're not talking here about the uniqueness of this context. I don't want to avoid it. I'll come to it in a moment. But we've got to remind teachers and get them to a point of understanding what good teaching and learning looks like in any context. That's critical, because if we default to we're in this strange circumstance, we're looking for unusual solutions. No, all the things that I would say to you about effective teaching and learning in your hybrid context apply directly to any regular classroom as well. So in saying that, some of the things I think are essential to effective teaching and learning in a hybrid context, it's terribly important to realise that the students are a vital resource to the teacher. Many teachers won't see that. They'll think it's their knowledge and their skill and their understanding and their background and their experience, them being the teacher. What you want to do is value the students so that other students see the benefit in coming together through this technology in this new, unique circumstance with other students. But that's exactly what I was always trying to do in a regular classroom. And all the designs of my physical classrooms that I've worked on with James and others in the UK and here in Australia was all about that in a single classroom environment. It was always about how do we create an environment where everybody can interact on an equal basis. There's no second class seats. And I would constantly berate the architects working on projects where they would give us a solution that was, you know, financially efficient, spatially effective, you know, in terms of squeezing lots of bums on seats into a space. And there would always be second class seats. I could identify them from the plans and the drawings. And I would have these huge fights with them and saying, I'm not having any second class seats in this room.
What's really interesting, Peter, is because I completely agree with you on that. And I've had the same arguments and the same bruises on my forehead of the brick wall of this is how we've always done it. But it chimes with a comment in our last episode on this podcast of Teaching Here and There from Dr. Jane Secker, who, when we posed a question to her about what's important in making hybrid teaching successful, she said the same thing. She said it's all about interaction. It's about group work. It's about students coming together. So that's really useful that we've got that continuity and what people think are important.
Yes, what I was leading to James, I completely agree with your colleague you've just referred to. So in the physical classroom, I was trying to do it in a single classroom, didn't matter the size of the class or the shape of the class. And now if you take it to the hybrid context, it's the same. I want the teachers who are in this context to be thinking, how can they activate the two sites or the three sites or however many sites or locations have been connected via these wonderful technologies so that students gain the benefit. If I'm in site A, the class is conducted in a way that I get genuine benefit by the participation of the students at site B or site C or site D. And because otherwise them being there is of no benefit to me whatsoever. It almost gets to the point where I could much better do this at home, sitting in my pajamas on the bed, you know.
Yeah.
That's the extreme end of it, and people argue that these days.
That's a really good point, because a lot of academics have said to us over the last year and a half, you know, working at universities, this issue about engagement. And you know, whether cameras on or cameras off is just an emotive subject or actually quite an important one in terms of engagement. If students switch off because they're not engaged, they don't see the value of their participation, they're not going to be engaged. So you've lost the battle. And, yes. and I think I want to come on to the next question, Peter. And I know we could talk all day, and we often do. But I'm really interested in a space that you showed me when I was very fortunate to come on a study trip to Australia 10 years ago, would you believe? And it was a brand new space that you designed in the main building in Melbourne. And I'm pretty sure you called it the e-learning room or the e-learning space. And I remember walking in, I was a bit jet lagged, I must admit, but why is this an e-learning room? It was a really interesting space. And I wondered whether that was you looking into a crystal ball or was the university thinking about how to bring remote students into a physical classroom in the way you designed that space?
It was my doing. You know, I had carte blanche really on those projects. I was expected to come up with the ideas. What I was trying to do, James, was if you recall the room, there were various seating heights in the room. I created some platforms around the edge of the room so to create different seating types and different seating levels so that there was great visibility. Everybody in the room could see everybody. How the students were clustered together enabled them to share and collaborate. They could move around the room and choose a range of settings to work at that suited them, that best suited them. But also when the room was connected technically to another location, everybody could participate on equal terms. There was no one in the back corner who couldn't be seen or heard. And I know that we took that same principle into a project that I did at your campus in London, where it was a very simple room. It was a rectangular room, as I recall, and we didn't have lots of money to do the project with or anything like that. But we introduced a principle of changing the height level so that the students seated at the back of the room were at a higher position so that they could have eye contact with the teacher and engage. They weren't hidden behind the first row students. Do you remember that project?
I do very much. I think what's interesting is this idea of interaction and how you bring students together. And yes. Something that I don't think there's very much what we've learned from the recent literature on this is whether when you put students in groups, do you have all the students who are online in groups or one group, and do you have the students in class in one group, or do you try and split them up? So you've got some students online, some in class in the same group. Now, I think there's a technical hurdle there, but from your point of view, would that be more preferable?
Pedagogically, either way, I don't have a preference for one way or the other. At that stage of the process, what's the critical stage of the process is the next one, and that is the exchange, you know, the exchange of what's happening, what's been thought through, what's been done, depending on the nature of the learning task that they're doing. They might physically be doing something or they might just be discussing something. But what's happened at each location should be made public and shared amongst all of the body of students who are participating, so that even though I might be in a same site group in my classroom somewhere in London, and there are students elsewhere, let's say they're in Dublin, and they might be again in their own groups there. When the teacher reconvenes the class, once they've been working on a task, I in London and my colleagues who are at the table in my group, we need to get some benefit by knowing and hearing what's happened in Dublin, because that makes it a richer experience for me. It doesn't matter whether the students in Dublin were working in the group process with students in London, Dublin and London. That doesn't matter. I mean, you can do that. There's no problem one way or the other. But ultimately, at the end of the process, what you've got to bring into the mix is the activity and the doing and the knowing that's taken place at all of the sites. Otherwise, me being in London, I get no benefit from what the students are doing in Dublin. And the students in Dublin might have come to a conclusion that's earth-shattering. But if there's no opportunity to reveal that to me in London, it's of no benefit to me whatsoever.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually, Peter, because that chimes with experience that Dom and I have had in developing some workshops, which you know about, called the Pedagogy of Space. We've done a number of these before the lockdown, and we had people working in groups, and it was the coming together and the sharing of their their responses and their thought processes that was the most illuminating.
And the visual
as well. You know, I think it's sharing things visually that people have gone through is really interesting. People's sketches, people's drawings. You know,
we're the facilitators of a session, learning from everybody else's learning.
I think this ties in really nicely with this idea of the, you know, that we've talked about the inclusive learning environment, and it's an inclusive learning experience.
So let me
come back to the fact that the students are the resource. That's the critical thing. The students are an active resource. They're not these neutral, empty things sitting there who don't know anything and don't have a view on anything. They're a resource to be used. It's like it's like saying I'm a band leader and I'm going to just use three of the people with instruments in front of me. I'm going to use a full orchestra. You get a much better sound, a richer experience if you use a full orchestra.
I like that analogy.
That's a nice one. Peter, just from the practitioner side that actually, as you said, came to the teaching from the industry without too much knowledge of the pedagogy itself, and of course, trying to build up myself on that side. What I realized in the last few months, when we finally got a chance to move back to the classroom again and mixing people on both sides, online and the physical space, what I realized, and I want to check with you whether it's actually something that came out of your research as well, it's very difficult to be alone in the room as a teacher, lecturer, professor, and try to juggle people who are online and not try to actually put aside people who are in front of you. How to overcome that alone, or do we still, or maybe do we really need a team that is together in a classroom managing this situation, who is the analogy of a flying pilot in command, and another one who is maintaining, as pilots know, communication and navigation in the space. What would be your thought on that?
I've been in all of those situations and also witnessed other people doing the range of contexts that you just described. You can be effective in all of those contexts. It depends on what the teacher is trying to do. The teacher's ambition is the critical thing in all of this. If the teacher's there to be the center of attention and the focus, and most university teachers, that's the starting point, unfortunately. That's how they earn their crust, by being clever and, you know, bright and well qualified. I understand that, you know, that's part of that world. But when you're teaching, it's how do you help the students learn? And so, yes, you might have people working at other locations, other staff members, you know, multiple staff members in attendance, participating and networking in this process, but you can't let their voices override the student voices still. So if you've got three teachers involved, the danger there, you have three teacher voices coming ahead of all the other student voices. That's a real concern. I want to emphasize over and over in this session, the power of the student voice is everything in this. Otherwise, the students might as well be doing a traditional correspondence learning course from 30 years ago, where there was no voice. And these technologies, I remind people, these technologies were developed initially to give voice to students who were in traditional correspondence programs where they had no voice. At first, started off with telephone conferencing, and the video conferencing initially was the extension of that. That was the next stage improvement, but it was to give them a voice because they could never feed back, they could never be heard. So the critical thing in all teaching, I think, is this: whether it's in a regular classroom, whether it's a great classroom that James has designed over there in London, a new generation learning space, or if it's one of these hybrid technology spaces we're talking about essentially today, we've got to remember that the essence of good learning for a student is to be exposed to the range of thinkings or knowledge or doings, depending on the nature of what the task is, that's happening within the total class. My exposure to that in my class, whether it's a single classroom setting or multiple sites linked by technology, my exposure to that is a thing that changes me or gives me the possibility to change my own understanding and my own knowledge. That's what learning's about. Learning happens when you enhance your knowledge, your skills, your understanding, the way you make sense of things. And you can only do that if you release and let go your existing knowledge or understanding. You know, I think 2 + 2 = 7.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. Oh, and I've realized, and someone, I've just listened to someone explain why it doesn't. Oh, I'm happy to let go 2 + 2 = 7. Now, that's a simple, at one end of the spectrum, that's, you know, an easy example. But more sophisticated example is, you know, how we make sense of what World War II was about.
Mm.
And I don't know why I'm using World War II today, but I am as an example. But you know, World War II, oh, that was just some good guys and some versus some bad guys, and the good guys won.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a simple version. And I could hold on to that view, and you know, we could all identify some good guys and some bad guys. But then someone else in the class says, no, you know, behind World War II was this imperialist sort of period in world history when some of the most powerful economic countries in the world sought to fight with each other over who controlled the resources of the world. And that led to a whole lot of argy-bargy that, you know what I mean? I'm not saying that's an accurate description of World War II's beginnings, but if I hold that view and I'm expressing it in the class, then James hears it and he's starting to think, well, maybe my view about the good guy Churchill versus the bad guy Hitler, maybe that's a bit simple.
I think
there's another way of making sense of this. And I'm prepared to now accept that there's another, and I'll come to that higher way of understanding.
Yeah.
That's what learning's about.
I think what's really interesting is something I learned from a certain Australian professor years ago, was this idea of the relationship between the teacher and the student, the relationship between the student and the student, and the relationship to the student and teacher to the content, to that mm-hmm. contextual information that's being shared and discussed. And I think
knowledge,
when you change the structure of that relationship, you're changing the learning experience. And something that my old head teacher, he wrote a book shortly before he died, and I read it recently. He talked about learning being about change and about people taking responsibility for that change.
Yes.
It aligns with that comment about transformation for higher education, Peter.
And we need to move on to our last question, Peter, to get the most of this expensive phone call to Australia.
Yeah, so I'm going to wrap things up. I'll just add that it's probably the first time I've heard World War II described as argy-bargy, but it's a nice way to think about it. let me wrap up with two closing questions here, very simple ones in a way. And I'll give you a chance, Peter, to respond to the first one before I ask the second one. First question is, you know, you were preparing for this particular discussion today. You've given some context in advance. What haven't we asked you already that you wanted to include in the conversation? What's there that you wanted to say that we haven't been able to get out of you so far?
I found this interesting because I didn't know that I'd have a chance to speak about the things that I wanted to speak about as fully as I have. I really wanted to emphasise student voice, and I really wanted to emphasise it's much harder to deal with this point that I was discussing at the end, the notion of what learning is, effective learning is. But teachers can't work effectively in these environments until they understand what effective learning is about. And so that idea that I was trying to, very simply and almost comically describe a moment ago about different understandings of World War II, the research in student learning shows us that if you take a class of students and identify their understanding of a particular subject, topic, or body of knowledge, you can identify 5 to 6 qualitatively distinct understandings that those students will have of this thing that they're learning. And the great teachers work in a way that exposes that range so that all the students become aware that there's a wide range of thinking and understanding in this class about this thing that we're all learning together, and then give students the opportunity to progress to a higher level of understanding. And all of the research tells us that that's what happens in classrooms, and that the best teachers work in that way. And that's why I'm emphasising the need to see students as the resource that should be activated, and that students should come to a class, whether it's a single classroom or these hybrid environments, and they should welcome and value the participation of the other students.
I like that when we gave you the opportunity to add whatever you wanted to say, and you came back to the same message that you've been saying throughout this as well. It's about the learning. fundamental.
It is, and I'm sorry that I repeated that, but I really wanted to highlight it and emphasise it, because for me, that's the essence of it. You know, I can then teach somebody, and I'm sure you could do it even better, how to speak properly and present well. And, you know, James and I used to talk about the importance in the design of physical classroom of creating a room where when the teacher was moving and interacting with the students, when a key point needed to be made to the entire class, that the teacher would locate themselves in a particular position. And that room that James was referring to earlier that I designed at Melbourne University was designed specifically for this, so that there were a couple of locations in the room where the teacher could stand that you would never say were the front of the classroom. But when the teacher stood there, the teacher could direct his comment or her comment to the entire classroom, and the students would know that this was something needed to be shared. And the reason this is important is that, and this I think applies to hybrid classrooms too, is that the teachers should be working in a way where they're having very specific conversations with individual students or clusters or small groups of students. And the challenge for everybody else in the class is you think, hang on, teacher Z's over there in the corner and spent a lot of time talking to table A, and he hasn't come over here and talked to us at all. Something critical needs to be said. The students need to realise, and the teacher goes to a particular place in the class where this is where something of importance to all of the class is said from. Otherwise, I found in my research when I was studying how teachers worked in these rooms that they would sort of make an offhand comment of real importance, but it was done in a way that students didn't even know that it was directed to the entire class and didn't understand the significance of it. So I had to teach the teachers, that when you're working in these rooms, you needed to step out of that small group discussion, go to a position in the classroom where you could announce, if you like, broadcast a critical point or a comment or a conversation, whatever you needed to do, that was to be shared with everybody. So that's a skill that teachers need to understand.
That's brilliant. I'm going to bring you back to the final question, which you mentioned a spectrum in one of your comments, responses earlier on. So we've got our own spectrum that we ask all of our guests at this particular point. When we first started talking about this podcast and talking with Ivan, with his background in aviation, we were thinking about calling it fight or flight. To some extent, let's think about those as different sides of the spectrum. So with fight being, you want to, this notion of hybrid teaching, you want to run as far away from it as possible. And we're subverting the sort of analogy a little bit. With flight, yeah, you're really taking off and you're really going for it. Where do you stand on that particular spectrum? And I'm going specifically for the hybrid teaching context here.
To use your analogy, and I'm inspired by the image of the aircraft behind you, I think in the past, traditional teaching, and still much of it, has been a model where the teacher's up the front flying the plane and everybody else is at the back of the plane in their various sections, and some are more privileged than others. So you got your first class. I'm sure James travels first class, but I never get to do that. Now you get down to your business class, and then you know, all us poor people at the back in the economy seats. And the service gets less good further back into the plane, and you feel completely removed from the entire process, I think, when you're down near the back, sitting near the toilets. That's how it's typically been. In my mind, what I would imagine and hope ideally it would be like is that there would be a giant cockpit, and all of the students would fit into the cockpit alongside the teachers, and they would all be flying the plane, and there would be no passengers at the back of the plane. That's how I see it.
Excellent. That's a really nice analogy to finish off with.
Assuming you're flying then, yeah. If everyone's flying.
We're all flying. It's a fantastic way to finish off this conversation. I appreciate your time, Peter. It's been fascinating hearing your insights and your recollections and bringing it all those thoughts to the fore of how we deal with hybrid teaching, which, let's face it, no one's saying this is a great thing we should all be doing. I mean, no one's saying that. But we're trying to make the best of this situation and looking for opportunities where it may become positive for certain students in this idea of inclusivity. Your thoughts are fascinating, and I'm sure it'll trigger a lot of conversations in the future. So just to sum up, final thoughts from Ivan?
Yeah, well, I love what I've heard, and actually it empowers me in my quest, because I gave up this industry job, the teaching job, and I wanted to share with the young people what I know. But now listening to Peter, I think it's really empowering everyone to look more into the theory, into the practice of teaching, and never forget that we have students at some time, maybe in the far corner, that actually have not been heard.
Thanks, Ivan. Final thought from you, Dom?
I think it's just good to hear the pro-learner perspective echoed so consistently throughout this conversation. That's been been a key driver in my own pedagogical approaches as a teacher myself over the years. Fundamentally, this sort of discussion, it's not about how you put some kit in a space together. It's about how you help people to learn. You know, if you're thinking about it from a teaching perspective, it's about how you help people to learn. And, you know, bringing Barack Obama or whoever in to your class can be a great way to help people learn, as long as you design a good experience to go with it. So just to thank you very much for your perspectives, Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, guys. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope it was useful in some way.
So that was a really fascinating conversation with Peter. I think I learned a lot from that, which is always one of the things that you go into these conversations hoping for. Ivan, what were your key reflections, takeaways, your key thoughts on our discussion with Peter?
Well, I think it's just fascinating to listen to a professional and practitioner of this profile. Probably our listeners can relate to what I'm saying now. We are coming into this profession of teaching for different reasons. Personally, I came from the industry of aviation to the teaching just to be able to share with the students what I survived, or maybe what I experienced in aviation. And then when you come as a professional into this field of teaching, you are missing how to touch the soft spots, how to touch the right buttons for students to learn the best. And what I've taken away from Peter's conversation, I think it's the gist of it is exactly this. We can have this technology, but it's important to realize that it's, again, a human factor, as we love to say in aviation, a human element, liveware, that facilitates and glues all things together. And that is what is going to stay with me for a long time. And I think hopefully it's going to stay with our listeners as well. James.
Brilliant. James, you brought Peter to the table today. What were your key reflections on the conversation?
Well, yeah. Inspiring and intriguing, and despite the fact he's been retired for a couple of years, his memories are very sharp, and his message really important, that it's about the students and it's about the learning. And that's something that I learned from him and others, but particularly in relation to learning space design. And I remember thinking about projects where we're bringing the outside in, you know, before we knew about hybrid teaching. This idea of bringing people in. And it wasn't just about the technology, it was about being inclusive and having wider audiences. And I think that key part about the students being a resource, not just for people to be sat at the back of the room during the lecture, but they are a key resource in that learning experience, where people bring their different learning experiences with their different learning styles and different understandings of the content, how people learn from that, and how it's a facilitating role of the academic to bring all of that together within the environment that we've created that's technical and physical.
I think it's important to realize also what he said at the beginning. I think this inclusivity of reaching out to people in prisons, in hospital beds, people in isolation, and giving them the opportunity to learn. And this is, I think, something that we have to also to remember and probably cherish.
Access to learning needn't be, you know, your physicality needn't be a barrier to access to learning.
Absolutely.
I think one sort of One recollection that the conversation brought me was my very first experience of teaching. So my mother was a teacher, and when I finished my O-level exams, I spent 6 weeks with her as a teaching assistant. She was a primary school teacher. But this conversation took me right back there as well, really, because I suppose the key message of, you know, it's about the learners as well. And the role of the teacher there is not so much to transmit what they know, but to be able to facilitate others in learning. And to some extent, you know, that means that, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're sitting in a tree with a bunch of people or whether you're in this, you know, highly technologized environment. It's all the same. So that wraps up today's episode 2 of Teaching Here and There. We hope it's been as interesting and as instructive for you as it has been for us. We are available on Apple Podcasts these days, so you can give us a rating over there. 5 stars, please. And you can give us a review. So do let us know what you think of what you've heard so far, what you'd like to hear coming up. We'll also look forward to bringing you some hopefully further interesting insights into this new approach to teaching and learning in episode 3. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.